Hey, this is Nick. I am the editor here at Real Crime Profile, and I just wanted to pop in here and give you a trigger warning for this particular episode, as there will be some discussion of some upsetting details about the recovery of Lacey's body, as well as the autopsy photos of her and baby Connor. So please take care of yourself.
In the second week of April, there was a big storm, big thunderstorm in San Francisco.
The Contra Costa County coroner has arrived at the scene and has now recovered the remains of the victim.
The police always believed that Scott Peterson had weighted down Lacey's body with anchors that he made. But she broke free of the anchors because of the storm.
On Monday, a badly decomposed adult torso was found in a marina in Richmond, California, not far from where Scott Peterson said he had been fishing at the time of Lacey's disappearance. A mile away, another grisly discovery, the body of an unborn baby boy.
My understanding is they're making arrangements to have the autopsy performed this evening.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and host of the podcast Crime Analyst. With me today is
Tim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And also with us today is
Lisa Zambetti. I am casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds and CBS Criminal Minds Beyond Borders and Audible's Bluebeard. And if you know me, you know how much I love people named Bob. That's why I am so excited for our guest here today. He's somebody who I have worked with, had the honor of working with on Criminal Minds. And will you please introduce yourself?
Sure. Bobby Chacon. I'm a retired FBI agent. I spent 27 years in the FBI working all different kinds of cases, from gangs and drugs and mafia to counterterrorism. And most of my career, 19 years, in fact, of 27, was spent underwater.
That's right.
We're so happy to have you on here, Bobby. Thank you so much for joining us. And it's your expertise that we can't wait to hear about, particularly regarding the case that we're talking about at the moment, which is the disappearance and murder of both Lacey Peterson and Connor Peterson. And I believe you were involved in the case, weren't you?
Yes, I was. At the time, I was the team leader of the FBI's Los Angeles field office dive team. That's the only dive team west of the Mississippi for the FBI. So we covered all of the western half of the United States. And so we got the call from Modesto PD, who was investigating the case, to see if we could come up and help them search that portion of the bay in San Francisco, actually on the Oakland side. Richmond Bay is the smaller part of the bay, for remains of Lacey during that case.
Well, Bobby, so do you recall when that was approximately?
I can tell you it was about 5 days after her body, or what was remaining of her body, washed up. And Connor washed up, I believe, either the day before or hours before, about a mile away from Lacey. And then Lacey's remains washed up on the beach. After Lacey's remains were found, that's when we were called to come in and find the rest of her, because it was not only was it partial remains, which is often the case in underwater, but there were crucial pieces missing that fit their theory of the case, that Scott had done it. Specifically, her hands, her feet, and her head were all missing.
So that, Bobby, was April the 13th and 14th. Connor was washed up initially on April the 13th and then Lacey on April the 14th. And before we get into the detail of the dive and what you had to do, you know, I'm not from here. I've been to San Francisco. I know San Francisco Bay, but can you just describe sort of the bay and just the currents. And I hear it's quite dangerous and the tides and the currents are very strong. What can you tell us about that?
Los Angeles, San Francisco Bay itself is very large. Obviously, the Golden Gate Bridge, the famous Golden Gate Bridge, goes over the inlet to that. And that is a very fast-moving body of water. Golden Gate Bridge is known as the most suicides or jump. People jump off that bridge more than any other bridge. When you hit that water, you're often taken out to sea. There are great white sharks. There are a lot of marine animals, around that body of water. The bay itself is really big. It's really large. The prison Alcatraz sits out in that water. Where we were searching was all the way. So then there's another bridge, the Bay Bridge, which runs from San Francisco over to Oakland, and there's bodies of water on both, both above and below that bridge. And then in the middle of that bridge is a small island, Angel where island. there's a U.S. Coast Guard base on that small island. And so that's where we were working at it. But the area that they wanted us to search was in the far eastern portion of the bay. It was called something like Richmond Bay. It was on the Oakland side. Mm-hmm. And it was it was much calmer. The water was no more than 10 feet deep. It wasn't like the main part of San Francisco Bay that, like you described, is very deep, very, challenging, the currents and stuff, all the stories of people trying to escape from Alcatraz and wind up drowning because those waters are quite treacherous. This area we were searching was less of that. It was more stable and it was shallower and it was much more on the eastern side of the bay. And that's because where they know Scott parked his car, there was a boat ramp. And so they wanted us to concentrate on that area around that part of the bay.
So, Bobby, given that, what was your protocol? What you were looking for the missing parts of Lacey's body, her arms, her legs, and her
head. We were looking for her hands, her feet, and her head.
So were her arms not? I thought her arms were disarticulated as well.
I saw a lot of the photographs of her both on the beach and back in the medical examiner's office, and her arms were there, her arm bones. There was flesh still on the upper part of the arms, but on the lower part it was pretty much bone. And then of course the hands were missing. The legs, the same thing. The upper part of the legs still had a good deal of flesh on it, but the lower part of the legs was pretty much bone, and then the feet were missing. Most of the middle of the torso were missing. Most of the organs were missing, and it was open. And of course, that Lacey's head was missing.
Okay, so can we? I'm sorry to our listeners that this is so graphic, but can we talk about that a little bit? When bodies go in the water, you've recovered a number of bodies over the course of your career. Am I right?
Yes.
And when bodies go in the water, don't they tend to bloat?
It depends. It depends on how they're killed. It depends on the water. Normally, a body will sink initially, then float, and then eventually sink again. If it's left on its own, that's what a body will do. It'll sink because the lungs fill up with water and it's heavy and it sinks. And then as your body starts degrading and the gases start coming out of tissue, if your body is intact, that your body acts almost, your skin acts almost as a balloon, and those gases fill up and you come up. But
you bloat, yeah.
You bloat and then you float. And then if you're left alone, ultimately, because your skin is not airtight, the entirety of your body is not airtight, those gases will ultimately escape and you will sink again. But normally, it's during that floating time period that people find those floating bodies. But eventually, if that's left alone, that body will sink again.
But when the bodies do float, when they do come up, they can be extremely large. They can be much bigger than they are in real life.
I mean, I've seen almost three times the size of them when they were alive. Yeah.
And the reason why I ask about that is because there's a tremendous amount that people are saying about the gestational age of Connor. And I just wonder if they took into account the fact that if he floated up to the surface, that he may have expanded because of internal gases, and they're looking at him in a state that is not his natural state.
You know, when I saw the pictures, he looked like a newborn baby to me. He on the beach, he didn't look all that much bigger than, and you know, that's certainly not my area of expertise. This would be somebody, you know, a medical person or an OBGYN person. But when I saw him, I thought it was clear to me that on the night of the 12th, there was a big storm that broke through the area, and it caused a lot of sea state in that part of the bay. And that the next morning is when Connor was found and then Lacey found later. The theory is that whatever was holding Lacey to the bottom broke her free from that storm surge, broke her free, and then she tumbled along the bottom at some point, lacerating her womb and ejecting Connor. And so Connor was protected, theoretically, the entirety of her being in the water until that last night. And as she tumbled across the bottom and allowed, you know, it could have been a tree or a rock lacerated her womb, ejecting Connor. And then Connor floated because Connor was found about a mile down the beach from where Lacey was found. But Connor did look to me, and I'm no expert in that, but he did look to me very well protected and very well much like if he had just been like a newborn.
Okay. And
yes, in fact, an anthropologist who examined him, Jim, just to help you out, did say, Dr. Alison Galloway, that she actually measured his bones, 5 separate bone measurements, rather than just looking at sight to estimate his gestational age. And so she gave her estimation, which was between 33 and 38 weeks. And to Bobby's point, she said that it was like he had been in the water for a couple of days, whereas Lacey had been in the water for 3 to 6 months. So, and I did speak extensively to an OBGYN actually, which we can come on to, just about all these sort of conspiracy theories about whether Connor was born or not, because that's doing the rounds at the moment, that there are some people who think that there was a live birth and Connor was born, rather than, as Bobby just explained, that the actual forensic pathologist, Dr. Brian Peterson, gave evidence to the tune that it was actually, as Bobby described, that he believed that Lacey had been underwater for some time, and that just before the bodies were washed ashore, that Connor was expelled. And that was the evidence that he gave, and we can get into the detail of it. But of course, there are no studies that show us or tell us that in 10 cases, this is what happened, or 30 cases, this is what happened when you've got a pregnant woman who has been killed and has been placed in the water. So it's very hard to draw any comparisons. That's why I'm really intrigued to talk to Bobby, who has spent his career in the water and has recovered many bodies. But I don't know how many pregnant women, Bobby, you've recovered before. Have there been other cases?
No, not for me, not pregnant. Well, we've obviously a lot of children, but no. The youngest child I recovered was 18 months old. But if you looked at the photographs of Connor and Lacey, you would know just by sight that, you know, Lacey was in the water a long time and Connor was not, you know, at least exposed to the elements.
Yeah, right. And that's important because her body, I mean, a woman's body is meant to protect the unborn. And it would have by having him still inside. And if, for example, she was tied down by 4 weights at her wrists and ankles and 1 at her head, then that could, you know, if those weights were sitting on the bottom and then the waters became agitated by that storm, then it very well is possible that she had been ripped away from those moorings and it took off. It basically took off all of her extremities.
Bobby saw the photos, and those photos are not public photos. So no one has seen them. So hearing Bobby describe what he saw is actually very helpful, mm-hmm. because there's so much speculation. And parts of the autopsies have been promulgated online, but not everything. And there's lots of discussion about whether the organs and the limbs, whether there was trafficking and organ harvesting and so forth. But Bobby, yes, and I, you know, raise an eyebrow at that. But Bobby, you talked about great white sharks and marine life. Could you just say a bit about the marine life? Because Jim and I both know from working our cases on land and water, of course, you do have animal predation. And as well as being weighed down and caught up, there's every possibility that there was, and I hate to say it, but it is the, you know, unfortunately, the detail of this case, that there could well have been animal feeding and animal predation.
There's no doubt that there was. I mean, almost everybody that I've ever recovered had some predation, some marine-like predation on it. Yeah, that's just natural. That's nature. But what you had, what added to it, what the factors of degradation underwater are the water temperature, cold versus hot, salt versus fresh, moving versus still water. And all of those things impacted. So you're in a salt water body, and salt is an astringent. Salt is you know, like sandpaper. And so as it's moving through and that area of the bay had tide action. There was tidal rises and falls there. So that, you know, we don't have that in a lake or a pond. So when you have that, water movement, you know, every 12 hours, you're having a massive amount of water movement. That's running that salt over the body. So, you know, salt water eventually becomes like sandpaper. And so the body will degrade naturally without predation. But that salt water acts as almost like scraping of the skin. And then more marine life comes because it kind of loosens up the body. The first things to go normally on a body underwater are, from predation, are the soft tissues, your eyelids, your earlobes, your lips, things like that, the softer parts of the skin. That's what the fish go for first. So a lot of bodies that I've recovered looked like they were looking at me because it looked like their eyes were open. But in reality, what happened was the marine life had eaten away their eyelids. And so you could see their eyeballs looking back at you. But so Lacey was in a warm water, shallow area, body of water that was subject to tides. Those all work against you when you're trying to preserve a body. Those all work to degrade a body quicker. Warm water, because it stimulates marine life. Cold water, less marine life. Salt, because salt is an astringent type of material. And then the tidal wave action of the water moving in and out every 12 hours with the tide.
And there's been some talk of the fact that if Connor was inside Lacey, unborn, but no longer alive, that he would have, quote, mummified within 2 weeks or start mummifying in 2 weeks. And they were found 3.5 months later. So I'm certain that whatever studies were done on that came to that conclusion, did not include, one, when the mother is deceased, and two, when the mother is in water. Those two factors have to be taken into account. You can't just say, because in normal circumstances this might happen, that it would happen when the mother and baby are submerged in water.
Yeah, I mean, if you had a case, for example, another case where a pregnant woman was killed and buried in a forest somewhere, and then you dug her up and you found her baby still in her womb, that baby's going to look a whole lot different than Connor looked, because she's in, you know, dirt in the earth. You're right, Jim. I mean, you know, the moisture would leach out of that body in the ground, whereas in Lacey's case, she stayed in the water the whole time. So I don't even know that you could have enough studies or enough real life examples to even make conclusions about that.
No, I don't either. But it's a mistake to draw conclusions from studies that have nothing to do with a submerged dead mother.
Sure.
and a child who's still in the womb. One of the things, though, Laura, you said that the estimate of the gestational age was how many weeks?
Well, put between 33 and 38.
So that's 9 months, right?
Yes. Yeah, so we have to remember that when Lacey went missing, she was put at 33 weeks.
Oh, okay.
So it's a standard deviation. Yeah, yeah. So people tend to take the higher end of that and say with a 38 to 40, right? So that he must have been born. And so that's why there's a lot of discussion about the fact that it's, well, there's one hypothesis that Lacey was kept alive, the baby was born, and then they're put into the water separately, and that Lacey's organs were harvested. So, you know, we're just trying to work through every hypothesis, which I don't believe that that was the case. But I think the biggest tell for me when we think about the baby, which it's absolutely horrific, this case in every way, but the meconium that was still in Connor's colon, for me, I remember giving birth, and the meconium is the first poop, if you will, of the baby. And that happens as a newborn. But the fact that Connor still had meconium in the colon, that tells me that it's most likely that there wasn't a live birth, that he was in utero. So I've just gone through this process. So it's very vivid in my mind. And there's lots of people that are talking about that and missing some of the finer detail. So I do believe that he was in utero and that somehow he came out. And Bobby, you can tell me whether this is right or not, but I have read various reports that you could see her uterus was intact, but I think from the belly button up was missing. So that was the area that they believe that Connor was expelled from, although she did have a bra on when Lacey was found. But in terms of what it looked like and sounded like from Dr. Brian Peterson's evidence, that Connor was expelled within a few days of the bodies washing ashore. And we can't completely ignore the fact that it was a mile apart and a day apart that they were found. That seems significant to me. What do you think, Bobby?
Well, I think that, you know, it does support the theory that, you know, she broke free during that storm surge and she tumbled for a while. And at some point, when Connor's expelled, now you have two different bodies. One is much lighter and smaller and more subject to being moved by the currents than the heavier one, obviously. That's just physics. And so it makes sense that Connor would wind up being found first and making it to the shore first, because Lacey is heavier and bigger and more angular. And as she rolls along the bottom, there's more things for her to get caught up with. And so it made perfect sense to me that Connor would be found not only sooner, but also away, because he would be taken by the wind currents and the water currents. He would be taken much quicker and much more in a different direction than Lacey.
All right, Bobby, another question related to this and to quell the theories of organ harvesting. You saw these pictures, and I'm sorry this is graphic, but you saw these pictures of a lot of her internal organs missing. Were these organs surgically removed, or was the cavity jagged and ragged?
The cavity looked like many that I've come across that of bodies that were in the water a long time. That's what it looked like. It looked like predation. It didn't, you know, the edges of the skin were jagged. There was no, you didn't see any kind of surgical cuts or anything like that. Not that there was enough skin left to look, but in the upper cavity, it did not look like to me like anything had been done on purpose or surgically at all. It was quite frankly a mess. It was just what you get when animals sea life feed. Yeah.
Right.
It's what you get.
That is the kind of fact that we would want to rely on in order to make a determination about that. Had her organs been harvested, you would have had a totally different situation. Were there any parts of organs still left?
Yes. They looked like there was some left. It didn't look completely empty. It looked just jaggedly open and stuff missing, clearly missing. But it didn't look like, you know, again, not to be too graphic, but I've hunted and I've gotten animals, deers, and where you take the innards out and you do that really carefully and you do it on purpose, it looks a whole lot different. It looks clean, and the organs are all removed in one particular one sack, because they're all kind of in one sack, and everything can get a bit removed, and then you just see the ribs and you see the spine and things like that. That's not what I saw.
There were still viscera attached.
Yeah, there was still a lot of different stuff. I mean, look, I much earlier in my career, I dove on the TWA Flight 800 wreck, right? There were 230 people at the bottom of the ocean. flight attendants, passengers, crew, and they were subject to predation. It was the ocean. It was deeper, but it still had, we still had crabs and lobster and fish. And I saw how, you know, a body we got the first week was different than the third month, because we were out there for 4 months. And I saw the advancement of animal predation on a body, what it looks like after a couple of days, what it looks like after a couple of weeks, and what it looks like after a couple of months on that one job. And this looked very much like that.
Like a body after a couple of months.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Bobby, because I think that clears up a lot of questions and theories people had with actual observation. Thank you.
I had a question about, does it surprise you that you weren't able to find, you were called out there specifically to find her skull or to find her head and hands and feet. Does it surprise you you were not able to find them? And is it unusual for you to find a torso that is missing the head, hands, and feet?
I mean, it depends on the case, whether or not, you know, we find those things. I'm not surprised we didn't find in this case, because I all along thought we were looking in the wrong place. I had some disagreements with the people who were telling us where to search. And that was because the detectives enlisted the help of a university scientists and who ran a lot of data through their weather computers and said, based on the wind patterns and the water currents and the storm surges and all of that stuff, they did a, you know, where Lacey was found, they reverse engineered it to where they thought she would be. And they put it there. That's not the way I usually start a search. I go by last seen point. And Scott was seen on the beach of an island out in that bay by a park ranger who he did not know was there. She saw him beach his boat and then pull the boat back out. The boat, something in the boat was covered by a blue tarp. That tarp was later recovered down the bay on the shore. I wanted to start searching from that point because I think she was still in his boat at that point when he beached it on that small island. And from there to where he took the boat out of the water, I would have drawn a straight line and I would have searched along that line. That was quite a distance from where we were searching.
So the Modesto police didn't have you search near the Berkeley Pier. You were somewhere else. Is that correct?
Right. Okay. We were in a big section that the scientists reverse engineered with all their data in their computers about from where she was found and the winds and the currents and the storm surge.
Did that make it into the trial, Bobby? Did that sighting of?
I don't know.
I've been going through the transcripts and I don't recall that park ranger.
Yeah, but that's incredibly significant information because their eyewitness that they're touting has having watched Scott pull the boat off the ramp and putter past them. He said he looked into the boat and there was nothing in the boat. Well, how could he have materialized this blue tarp? One, there might have been nothing in the boat. He might have gone to an area where he dropped the blue tarp off that was wrapped around Lacey's body on the side of the shore and then went out, took it out from there because he didn't want to go to a populated area with a boat with Lacey in it. He could have dumped her body temporarily on the side of the shore and then gone out with the boat to take it out deep into the water. Or he had it in the bottom of that boat the whole time, but we know he didn't magically make that tarp. He put it in that boat either when he left the warehouse where he was, where the boat was kept, or he put in that boat sometime afterwards when he was in the boat on the water and away from people. So those are the two options. But if this park ranger who was completely unaware of saw him with this blue tarp and the blue tarp was later recovered, there's a very strong likelihood that that tarp was covering Lacey. There's no other reason for him to have the tarp in the boat and put it outside the boat.
I'm sorry, I want Laura in here, but Bobby, who told you that story of the park ranger? I mean, where did that come from?
That's when we were briefed when we first got up there by, you know, all the dive teams. So there were about eight or 10 dive teams.
He was part of the investigation. This was,
yeah, it was part of, the detectives probably told me that. I had kept in touch with one of them for a long time, but I don't remember. It's got a kind of an odd name, but yeah, that came from them. Remember, this is, I think when we were searching, Scott was still, I don't even know if he had been arrested yet. Was he arrested before Lacey was found? Maybe, I don't know.
No, he was arrested shortly after.
Yeah, he was still out. So we were kind of, everything was, you know, the information was new and some was, you know, credible, some wasn't and all that stuff. And so it didn't matter as much to me as just, I wanted to start the search in a different area. And you know, we're looking for very small, you know, things. It matched up with the fact that they said he had in his storage unit, he had this, you know, concrete powder. And then he had those flower pots that he made the weights out of, supposedly the ceramic flower pots you find at a Home Depot or something. And then he poured the concrete in there, put hooks in there and chipped away the pot after the concrete had hardened. And those were the weights he used. So one on each wrist, one on each ankle, one on the neck. And so we were told she was face down in the water. And so what happened was, through wave action, it was described to us as, you know, the depth of that and the length of the ties. It was possible that at low tide, the back of her body, her back might have been exposed to the air. And again, that was part of the, I don't know if the medical examiner looked at that, but someone said at one point that it looked like there was evidence that some of the back of her was subject to sunlight every day. And some, you know, you get different things happen to the skin because it was out of the water for a time. And then once the tide came in, it covered her, you know, but I don't know how much she was out of the water. It was only a little bit or what, but they said that when they examined some of her, and this would come from the medical examiner, I imagine, that there was some evidence possibly that her back was out. So she's doing kind of this, like her body's doing this. It's kind of up and then it's
bobbing,
down.
It's bobbing, and
it's kind of bobbing up and down. And what that is doing is causing tension on the joints. And eventually with the salt water and the force of the tide working on it, it just weakened those joints. And then that storm surge just broke them free.
Yeah, I just think it's so significant what you're saying, Bobby. I mean, the ranger sighting, which is really significant. And he said that he was fishing at Brooks Island, right? And what's the distance, do you know, from Brooks Island?
No.
You're not sure about that?
I don't know.
Would you know if that's an area that you would go to fish in the middle of the day? Is that sort of a known fishing area?
I would know. I don't know those waters other than the time I spent on them. I just know that, you know, somebody once said, like, you know, of all the things in your career you could go back and do again, this is the search I would do again. And this is the body of water I would go back to, because, you know, I think there's still four weights with things tied to them down there.
Under your parameters that seem to make a lot more sense. And my last question before Jim dives back in, no pun intended, but I know that the umbilical cord and placenta were not found. And again, lots of people read into that. That's because Connor was born. But in your view, I know you're not a medical professional, but given that body of water and given if it were in the water for 2 or 3 days, would it be more likely that, again, animal feeding, animal predation were responsible for that in that time?
Yeah, I would think so. And remember, with the placenta and the things you're describing are soft tissue. And again, the sea animals always feed on the soft tissue first because it's just easier for them to rip and digest and eat. And so the placenta and those kind of afterbirth things are soft by nature, soft and tissue. And those are the things that would be eaten fairly quickly by, the abundant marine life that's in that area.
And
that's horrific, but it's significant because the cord wasn't cut or tied. It was frayed. So it does sound like animal predation.
So the last question I have, during the trial, Scott's lawyer, Mark Garagos, conducted tests with a boat. And he said that he had a diver, you know, an experienced diver go in the same boat and that he could not lift a 100-pound weighted dummy out of the boat without flipping the boat over. Now, you actually work on the water and underwater. Isn't it possible, let's say, that there was a body that, say, weighed 150 pounds, and then there was five weights tied to it, that Scott could have positioned himself on the opposite side of the boat and then put the weights over the boat, and then it would have been very easy because those weights now are in the water and pulling on the body. It would have been very easy to lift that body up, you know, legs first.
Flip it right over the edge.
And roll it right over the edge, but counterbalance it by being on the other side. What this idiot did in this test that he wanted in was stand on the same side of the boat as the body, and then, of course, all of his weight and the body's weight, it tilted the boat down, it started taking in water, and then he flipped the boat.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it would be, I wouldn't say it would be easy, but it's doable to get her out without flipping that boat. I mean, there's a number of different ways. Like you said, you could have kept her body inside the boat and the weights kind of over the, you know, over with the tide on the outside of the boat. And then you, all you have to do is give her a little push, and then the weights are already on the outside of the boat and would pull her over and in. The other thing is, if, and I don't know, this is, again, just theory. If he got out on that island and put her out on the side of the boat, and just towed her to where he wanted to let her go. He could have towed her with the body in the water. There was a reason why he stopped on that island.
Right.
Nobody knows, but theoretically he could have, at the island, which is much easier to do, then get her out of the boat, you know, in waist-deep water, and then just hold on to her or tie her to the boat and drag her to a point and then just cut her loose.
Right. Well, Bobby, if this does go to trial again, if a judge grants him a new trial, I am going to make sure that I contact the whoever the prosecutor is and tell them that they should have you do a counter demonstration to show just how easy it is for somebody who actually knows what they're doing in a boat to not fake that they're an idiot and be on the same side of a small boat as a body and then try to lift that body up. Because obviously that's not how it should have been done.
Right. I mean, look, there's a number of ways you can do it. It's not, you know, it's all conjecture, right? It's conjecture. His test is all conjecture. It's not, there's nothing fact-based
right, but it's
about
conjecture,
his test if that's how it happened.
It's conjecture meant to fail. That's what it
exactly.
is.
Exactly. It's one way that you can't do it. There exactly. are 100 ways you can do it.
Right. Mm. There you go. All right. Well, thank
right,
you so
Bobby.
Much for being here, Bobby. We really appreciate it. And I'm sorry that your career's had so many difficult times, but you know, I know that, you know, you helped so many officers and so many families by the work that you did in underwater body recovery.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Take
thank
care.
Thank you, Bobby.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thank you. Thanks, Laura. Thanks.
Take
Lisa.
Care.
Bye.
Bye. Wow. Jim and Lisa, that was absolutely invaluable talking to Bobby, who was actually working
Definitely.
The investigation. You know, there's no substitute for it, is there? Particularly with this sure. case where there's just so much speculation, there's so many assumptions being made about what happened. And we should definitely debrief what we heard from Bobby and just where it sits with all the rest of the timeline, the facts, the information and the evidence. But that was really instructive to me. So we're definitely going to come back and talk some more about this case. There's so much more because there's so many twists and turns in it that we have to cover to do the case properly. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like listening to our show and appreciate the work that Jim and Laura do and their expertise, you can do us a big favor. Please head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our pod and leave us a 5-star rating and write your thoughts about why you enjoy our show. It really, really is important and helps other people find us. Also, did you know that you can share our episode? It is so easy. On the Apple Podcast app, click the 3 dots drop-down menu and you'll see an option to share to your socials or to a particular person, and then they can hear for themselves why you love listening to Real Crime Profile. Thank you so much for your support.
Real Crime Profile was created by Jim Clementi, Laura Richards, and Lisa Zambetti. Produced by Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, Jim Clementi, and XG Productions, and distributed by Wondery. Editing by Nick Jaworski at Podcast Monster. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba.